Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, with your host, Randy Sutton.
Welcome to this week's episode of Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, and Blue Lives Radio. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. Thanks so much for tuning in. We've got a great show for you today. We have an excellent interview with head of the National Sheriff's Association, which is the largest sheriff's association in the country. And we're going to talk to him about what's been going on in the world of law enforcement. You'll also hear a police story written by a former police officer with the LAPD. And before we go any further, let's take a little walk into the briefing room where you will hear my view from the blue.
The Briefing Room. Headlines, stories, and all that touches American law enforcement.
CNN came out with a headline today that the Charlotte, Mecklenburg police officer, Brentley Vinson, has been cleared of any wrongdoing in the shooting death of Keith Lamont Scott. Now, this shooting took place September 20th, and if you'll remember, this was the cause of unrest, riots, violence, etc. Similar in style to Ferguson and Baltimore. Now, let's go back to what took place at this shooting, okay? The police were at an apartment complex, and they were looking for another suspect. This suspect, Keith Scott, was observed by police officers smoking dope and holding a gun. Well, when they saw the gun, the officers knew that they had to take some type of action. So they did everything by the book. They put on their identification gear, you know, that showed that they were actually law enforcement officers, vests and jackets and things like that. They had enough police officers there to confront him, and with overwhelming force. And he was ordered to come out and drop the gun. Well, he made a choice. He decided that he was not going to drop the gun. What made this case to bring this case to the attention of the public in such a dramatic way is that, once again, there was someone, in this case, the wife of the suspect, on the scene with a cell phone camera. So all of this action was being recorded. In addition, there was body cam footage of the incident as well. What was very clear from this encounter was that the suspect ignored repeated commands to drop the gun. He was told, and I believe it was recorded about 10 times, that Officer Brentley Vinson, who, by the way, is black, gave the commands to drop the weapon about 10 times. And when the suspect refused to do that and turned towards Vinson, Vinson felt that he was in imminent danger. The suspect had the gun in his hand, and he opened fire and he killed the suspect. Now, what you could hear in the background was the suspect's wife urging him to not do it, quote, don't do it, don't do it. And then when the shots were fired, she was screaming, you didn't shoot him, you couldn't have shot him, you didn't kill him, did you? And it was very emotional. You could hear it. Here's the problem. Immediately the lies began. Immediately the witnesses, quote unquote, crawled out of the woodwork, including, by the way, the suspect's wife, and lied. They lied about the shooting. They said that there was no gun. They said that the suspect was holding a book. They said that he never threatened the law enforcement, and that the police gunned him down and murdered him. And what happened? Of course, the media picked it up. The media ran with it, and the media made the police look like they were murderers. It was originally reported that it was a white police officer, thereby bringing the racial aspect into this. And when it turned out that the officer was actually black, well, that was just a minor inconvenience for those trying to paint law enforcement as racists who gunned down innocent people for no apparent reason. Well, it sparked riots, it sparked violence, and nothing could be told to the media or to those who whose political agendas and social agendas revolved around the violence and revolved around protesting. Unfortunately for them, it was a lie. And it was apparent when law enforcement actually talked to all the witnesses away from the cameras, away from the media. And when it came down to it, they admitted, well, they didn't really see it. And the wife, who claimed that she had no knowledge about this individual, her husband having a gun, and that she denied it and denied it and denied it, it was discovered in evidence that they had had several arguments about him possessing this weapon. By the way, he was also an ex-felon. He wasn't allowed to own a gun. The gun was stolen. And the fact of the matter is that he had served time in prison for shooting someone else. So we had a violent offender armed with a stolen handgun, and the wife lying to law enforcement as well as a number of witnesses. So when the district attorney just today, approximately 2 months or so after the shooting, revealed that there were going to be no charges against the law enforcement officer, you would think that a great injustice had been done, even though it was clear that the officer acted properly. There is the threat of violence once again. There are calls from the media who simply cannot believe that this police officer was ruled justifiable in shooting this poor suspect. And once again, the lies continue to take over and continue to grow the violence. When are we going to listen? When are we going to believe that law enforcement is not randomly gunning down innocent people? Everyone in law enforcement knows this, and when they heard what was being spewed out by the media and by the lying witnesses, they inherently knew it, just as they knew from Ferguson and Michael Brown's case. America, it's time to wake up. It's time to support your law enforcement. They're the ones telling the truth, not the ones manipulating you. And that is my view from the blue.
You're listening to the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network. Well, it's where we say, let the silent voices be heard. You'll find a whole host of shows and a lineup of great content back at AmericaOutLoud.com.
With me today in the interview room at Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, is the president of the National Sheriff's Association, St. Charles Parish, Louisiana Sheriff Gregory Champagne. And Gregory has been the sheriff for 20 years, sitting sheriff for 20 years, and he has been the president of the National Sheriff's Association. We're about halfway through his term. Sheriff, thank you so much for being on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You know, one of the things that I was impressed about and why I reached out to you was the respect level that I heard in the voices of your people that work for you. And that's not often the case these days when it comes down to leadership of law enforcement. So I was happy to reach out to you, and I appreciate you taking time to be on the show.
Well, thank you again, and I appreciate that, and I appreciate them feeling that way.
So, many people don't know what the mission is of the National Sheriff's Association. Can you briefly go into what the size of the organization and what the mission is?
Well, there are, to be exact, I believe, 3,088 sheriffs across the country. The overwhelming, vast majority, well over 95%, are elected, directly elected by the people, which we take great pride in. The mission of the National Sheriff's Association is essentially to protect and preserve the office of sheriff and to maintain and promote it to the highest levels of professionalism, et cetera, in law enforcement.
And you have been a member of that organization for how long?
Since I became a sheriff. I joined right away, so 20 years I've been a member. I've served on the board. I was elected to the board of directors in 2003, and 2008 or 9, I ran for sergeant at arms, which is the beginning of the executive officers group, a seven-person group of officers. And once you get elected to that contested position of sergeant at arms, there you automatically move up and gain experience to become president.
I understand. So, as the leader of the largest sheriff's association in the country, how have you gauged what has been taking place in the last couple of years as far as the plight of the American law enforcement officer, and how is your organization working to make conditions better?
Well, as not just affecting sheriffs, but all law enforcement officers, as we all know, the incidents, and we can all kind of point back to Ferguson, Missouri, as well as the Baltimore incidents, the police-involved shootings there, which really, we think, kicked off the last couple of years of unrest around the country. And to make it worse, what we really or have been upset about is that whether you're a police officer or someone who gets charged with a crime on a street, whenever an incident occurs, there has been a rush to judgment on the part of, unfortunately, prominent officials, including the President of the United States, unfortunately, to prejudge these incidents. The system is not, as we like to say, an instantaneous system. You know, the chance of the protesters are, what do we want, dead cops? When do we want it now? Or what do we want, justice? When do we want it now? Justice is not instantaneous. It is a process based upon the Constitution of the United States, in particular the Bill of Rights, and it takes time for all sides of the story to unfold because people who are accused are charged with crimes, their rights are involved, and they're entitled to present their defense, to consult with their attorneys, and it takes time for the evidence to come out. So what we've seen is national officials, both with the government and some national agitators, have come out immediately condemning police-involved shootings, proclaiming that the officers were guilty of crimes, were murderers, things like that. And that fueled an animosity, which then appealed to another segment of our population. And I don't mean to claim that everyone who attacks a police officer is mentally ill, but I think it's pretty clear that many, many are. And a failure of some of our national politicians and state and local politicians has been to provide adequate mental health treatment around this country. It has been getting worse and worse for many years. And when you have a situation where this red-hot inflammatory rhetoric, anti-police rhetoric is out there, then you have these mentally ill people who are looking at that. They're sitting in their basements on computers, and they're getting fired up, and they see it as a call to action. And so we've seen that. We've seen that in my own state in Baton Rouge. We saw that with the Dallas police assassinations. And we attributed all directly to this inflammatory, incendiary rhetoric on the part of people, irresponsible individuals, some high in government, who provoke this stuff. So it has been a difficult time answering your question, unfortunately, in a very wordy manner.
Oh, no, I appreciate exactly what you're saying. I understand the situation entirely. You know, as a 34-year law enforcement officer myself, I've watched almost with a great deal of chagrin as I have seen our own president in a sense, lead the charge against law enforcement. You know, when he first came into power in 2009, it wasn't very long before he, you know, came out publicly against a Cambridge police sergeant, where he said that he acted stupidly. And to me, that appeared to be kind of the line in the sand that he drew, and it began deteriorating at that point.
I think that's true, and unfortunately, that continued. But let me say this now, to his credit. Unfortunately, it took a long time to come. But in the wake of the Dallas police assassinations, essentially, we met with the president and we called this to his attention, and I we believe that he finally came to realize that the rhetoric was putting officers' lives in danger. Unfortunately, it came late in his administration, but I do believe he finally realized, a bell went off, that he realized that the rhetoric, the prejudgment of cases, comments, public comments, were not only counterproductive to the system of justice, but they were putting law enforcement officers' lives at risk.
So did you have a face-to-face meeting with the President of the United States about this?
I did not. My executive director did.
So the executive
director... Well, there were meetings of several of the major law enforcement organizations, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, the Major County Sheriffs, National Sheriffs Association, several groups. Vice President Biden had held a series of meetings, and the president joined in unexpectedly on one of those. And there was a pretty intense discussion about it, but all the reports I got back directly from those who were there was that he did finally realize that these words really were possibly putting officers' lives in danger.
Well, that's very interesting. That's the first I've heard of that. What? But you know, even since then, the number of shootings of law enforcement officers has just gone through the roof. And yet, you haven't heard him address it one little bit.
No, I mean, look, I'm not trying to say it's been a complete turnaround and everything is wonderful. We have not. I mean, we've felt that we've been on defense really for the last several years. Law enforcement in this country, it seems like it was constantly something under attack for us. Equipment being taken away, criticism, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, we're hopeful now. We have a new president who's coming in. And he said all the right things, and so we're hopeful that his statements will turn into action and trustworthiness for America's law enforcement officers. And we're not, make it clear, we're not asking for special treatment. We're just asking for justice and fairness that anyone would get. We're no prejudgment of situations. Let the facts, let there be full investigations anytime force is used. But you are right in the fact that we're now, I believe, the last statistics show that we are 75%. We've had 75% more law enforcement officer death by firearms in 2016 than at this point during the year 2015. So, yes, law enforcement deaths, in particular, death by firearm, is substantially up this year.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that I have I've been very critical of is law enforcement leadership has, in essence, kind of buried their own heads in the sand as well. You see many street level officers who are feeling that they're not getting the backing of their chiefs and their sheriffs, and that they're political pawns should they get involved in a deadly use of force. And so we've seen this pulling back. Some call it the Ferguson effect. Some call it depolicing, taking place within the agencies of this country. What is your stance on that particular situation?
Well, my personal stance as a sheriff is, as we've always told our personnel, you know, we try to provide them with the best tools, the best training, and we tell them, we're going to back you if you're right, but we're going to do investigations. We're going to hear both sides of the story. And so there is no chief of police, no sheriff, no deputy or police officer that wants to be the subject of the next crisis in America, where there's a shooting involved and all hell breaks loose, for lack of a better term. I mean, nobody wants to be in that situation, but I think leaders and executives, we owe it to our people to train them as best we can and to do fair and complete investigations and not prejudge cases. Do the same thing what we're asking everybody else not to do. To be fair and just and allow the investigations to take their course, and that way objective decisions can be made about what occurred. And, you know, if they're, like I tell my people, you know, we're going to back you. You're right, we're going to back you.
Exactly. And, you know, that brings up a very good topic, though, is police training. You know, you can go from state to state, and then even jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and you see a wide disparity of the training given to law enforcement officers. And do you think that there should be some type of national standard for training for law enforcement?
You know, that's been talked about, and I think it's right now, of course, it's a state by state. I mean, we're really opposed to any federal dictates on our profession. We would prefer local and state control of our agency. So we're opposed to national, you know, some type of national control. I think there has been a trend towards you know, more standardized training of all agencies, but admittedly it does vary from state to state. The requirements of the basic police academies, as well as the amounts and types of in-service training that occurs. But I think we should be able to handle that in our own house without seeking a national directive or order.
Well, I know exactly what you're saying there, because having a, you know, there is a fear that the Department of Justice, with their overreach over the last couple of years, you know, have been making moves to nationalize law enforcement in certain ways. Has that been a concern of yours?
Well, this has been a very, very aggressive Justice Department, in particular Civil Rights Division. And, you know, they have a role, and I do believe that they have overreached in some instances. So, but we are opposed, the National Sheriff's Association certainly is opposed to national guidelines, national rules. There can be suggested guidelines, but we prefer to use our own with our own association. You know, I know the International Association of Chiefs, you know, has their own model policies, et cetera, et cetera. But we oppose federal dictates, because you can lose control of those very quickly.
Yeah, that's truly a concern. Well, when it comes down to the federal guidelines and suggestions, you know, we've seen the under the Obama administration, the 21st century policing rules or suggestions come out from PERF, the Police Executive Research Forum. And in reading some of those, I had to shake my head at many of those, because they didn't really concern the safety of police officers. That seemed to be the last concern of those, quote, police leaders, unquote. How do you look at that, those PERF guidelines and interpret them?
Okay, well, first off, I think the guidelines from PERF are a separate issue from the Task Force on 21st Century Policing report. So I think we're talking about two different things right there. Yeah, a lot of us had a lot of concern about the PERF's recommendations. And I have participated in the, we're working right now with IACP and several national organizations to come up with a model use of force policy. And it's been contentious. You know, policy should be general and general enough to where it provides, you know, adequate guidelines for everybody else, but not so specific where it puts police officers in a corner, because every situation is different. Every situation has its own dynamics. But, you know, there should be a general, you know, use of force policy, which complies with basically the law of each state. You know, the law of self-defense was ultimately, when we're talking about lethal force, is the laws of self-defense, which really are the bottom line. Going back to the task force in 21st century policing, when that task force was formed, admittedly, a lot of sheriffs and chiefs were concerned that it would come out to be an anti-police document, to be honest with you. But we had some very good representatives there. We had a former sheriff who was on the group. You had law enforcement representatives as well as people from other types of groups and agencies. And I have to tell you that the sheriffs believe, after looking at it now for, you know, going on almost 2 years, is a lot of what came out ultimately in 21st Century Policing Task Force are things that sheriffs have been doing for a long time. The community outreach programs. I mean, sheriffs, as I said in the very beginning of the program, we take pride on the fact that we are elected by and accountable directly to the people. We don't answer to mayors. We don't answer to city councils, although many sheriffs have to go to counties for budgets. We don't answer directly. We're independent law enforcement executives who are allowed to run our own agency, with the caveat that we are accountable to our public. And so sheriffs, being elected, you know, any public official wants to be successful. They want to get reelected. So they have to do certain things in order to do that. So it's a line we walk, you know, where you have to enforce the law firmly and fairly with your citizens and not be subject to political pressure. You know, you've got to be fair, and yet you want to have the approval of your public. And so a lot of sheriffs do that well. If you look at the reelection rate of sheriffs, it's extraordinarily high. Those that seek reelection generally are reelected in very, very high percentages. So that's a big factor. But the bottom line is well, there's some things in the 21st Century Policing Report we find, not unreasonable, but a bit strong. The vast majority of it are things that sheriffs feel that we've been doing. One thing I think we've been the weakest at is officer wellness programs. You know, everybody knows that an officer who's not physically or psychologically well is not a good officer. And I think agencies around the country would benefit by taking a look at that one, and such as we're doing right now, trying to institute wellness programs, both, you know, physically and mentally, for our officers and deputies. That's an important one. But overall, I think sheriffs, we've been doing a lot of the things that the 21st Century Task Force report actually recommends, and these are recommendations. It's the basis for I think for a good law enforcement agency.
No, I agree that there were many things in that report that came out that were basically just, in a sense, codifying things that have been just standard police practice in many communities for many, many years. You know, it's interesting that you talk about wellness. I had a guest on the program a couple weeks ago, Colonel Dave Grossman, who you're probably familiar with, and
yeah.
he spoke at length about studies that he has been involved in involving the sleep deprivation of law enforcement officers and how that adversely affects their health and also their performance. And is this something that is being looked at on a national level?
I think most agencies, it's not an issue that I hear talked about a whole lot, although I think it's an important concern, and I think all agencies should monitor that. But I think many agencies have in place rules and requirements for, you know, the length of off-duty details, the amount of sleep an officer must get before returning to his regular shift, and things of that nature. So I think a lot of agencies look at that, but it certainly could be an important factor.
As we enter a new era, hopefully, of you know, United States governmental, hopefully, cooperation with law enforcement, as opposed to some of the opposition that we have seen in the last 8 years. How do you think we should move forward in creating a better environment, a safer environment for law enforcement officers, and building better relations with the people that we serve?
Well, and let me go back to really kind of what I just said and elaborate on that. The idea of community outreach. One of the things in the 21st Century Report says that law enforcement agencies need to do community outreach. Well, most sheriff's offices have been doing a lot of community outreach for a long period of time. I'll give you some examples. the DARE program. That's community outreach. I mean, we've been doing DARE for almost 30 years in St. Charles Parish. And if you think about it, every fifth grader for the last 25 years has had close personal contact with a sheriff's deputy teaching a DARE curriculum. And it's not just the learning about, you know, the drug resistance ideas and all that. It's the relationship that they build with a uniformed deputy. So every fifth grader in St. Charles Parish for 25 years has had a semester with a uniformed deputy building that bond. My agency, we send approximately 75 kids to camp, and that might not sound like a large number, but we're not a large parish. It is a large number. For the last 20 years, we have the Boy Scouts let us use a camp in southern Mississippi. So every year, about 75 kids go, and we send them with about 10 deputies who volunteer to go. So they get to camp out, go canoeing, archery, things like that, with living and breathing sheriff's deputies. So when you add up those numbers over 20 years, you're again talking a couple of thousand kids, or between 1,000 and 2,000 kids who were building those relationships. The National Sheriff's Association developed the Triad program, which is it's a senior citizen safety and crime prevention program, and have contacts with those citizens. And I could go on and on about the different school programs, summer programs, things we do, neighborhood watch programs. You know, anytime you're out interacting with the community, it's a good thing. It builds those relationships, that community outreach. Citizens Academy. Many agencies, sheriff's office do citizens academies, where citizens come in and they go through several weeks of learning the basics of what law enforcement officers confront, the dangers they confront, and the things that they're responsible for doing, how much training they need to do it all every day. So all of these things contribute to the idea of community outreach, establishing long-term relationships with the people who live in the community.
When you look at the longevity of police chiefs in that police in that position, as opposed to the the sheriffs, there's a huge disparity. I think the shelf life of a police chief nationally is about 2.5 years, because unfortunately, they have to deal with a different kind of political situation than you as a sheriff does, and I think that causes a lot of issues for them. What do you see for the future under this new presidency? How do you see our country changing in regards to the law enforcement mission?
Well, you know, as we all know, this presidential election has been very, very contentious. Even the aftermath continues to a large degree to be contentious. So I don't think we can expect a love fest from 100% of the public overnight. I mean, it's going to take time, but I don't mean to suggest that law enforcement should not do its part. To the contrary, I think great strides have been made in the last couple of years in light of all the high-profile incidents. I think training techniques are up. I know, you know, we're doing more and more. One of my flagship programs this year as president of the National Sheriff's Association is we're promoting a national online leadership and ethics program, which I have implemented in my office about 2 years ago. And I can say it's one of the best things I've ever done for morale, for confidence among the public. And it for far too often, we have focused on the fact that leaders must be at command-level positions. This program is based on the concept that every deputy, whether you be a deputy on up to chief deputy or sheriff, you're a leader in your world. You're a leader between and among your peers. You're a leader with the public that you deal with. So, you know, there are a lot of good things going on out there. We need to probably the big benefits of the last couple of years are that agencies are doing a lot of increased ethics and various types of training. And so we've got to do our part. We can't look away and say, hey, we've been doing everything great. We don't need to change. We should always be looking to change. The time changes. Technology is changing at light speed, and we've got to stay ahead of it. So I think if we do those things over time, things can get better. I mean, with the Gallup poll 2 or 3 weeks ago showed that 75% of Americans feel strongly positive about law enforcement. That's a good thing. What we got to do now is work on that other 25%.
You know, I'm glad that you brought that up, because I think that reveals what Americans really do think about their law enforcement officers. And it was interesting when you dug a little deeper into those those numbers, that those were not just representative of individual communities, but of basically communities across the board that felt that way, minority communities as well as non-minority communities. And I had to laugh about was that you hardly saw any mention of that on some of the national media outlets when that Gallup poll came out.
No, you had to dig kind of deep to find that story, unfortunately, with our national media, which I don't believe we have a national media anymore. It's all special interest extensions of political ideologies.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think you're right. Now, if people want to get more information about the National Sheriff's Association, is there a website or some type of social media they can look at?
We have both. You go to, you can Google National Sheriff's Association. Our website is www.sheriffsplural.org. We also have a Facebook page, National Sheriff's Association. I believe we've got 200,000 likers on it. So I urge you to connect to our Facebook page where we put out a lot of ongoing information. And again, check our website, and we look forward to the public visiting our site.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for being on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I appreciate you taking the time to be with us, Sheriff.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. I appreciate it.
This is Police Story, the real stories from those behind the badge.
Each week, I read a police story, a story written by a retired or active duty law enforcement officer. And if you have a story that you would like read on the air, send it to me at randysutton@americaoutloud.com. This week's story comes from True Blue to Protect and Serve, and is written by a sworn officer of the Los Angeles Police Department who retired after 25 years. Her name is Trinka Parada, and the story is entitled Jesse, a case study in sexual assault. The young woman moved confidently through the early morning chill, oblivious to the traffic and other people around her, caught up in thoughts of her upcoming math test. Life was just fine. Her boyfriend, her job and school, her conservative existence in a religious organization's dormitory for young ladies. Suddenly, the tall, thin black man leaped from his parked car, grabbed her, and quickly forced her inside. She wrestled, screamed, and pounded the horn. Assistance came in the form of a hospital security guard who challenged the thin man, withstood his threats of karate violence, and wrote down the license number as the assailant sped away. It was all over so quickly. A scary interruption in her life, a bit of a delay while making a police report, an explanation for being late to school, and life was pretty much back to normal. As police reports go, it wasn't much. Attempted kidnap, briefly and casually written. But it did contain that precious license number that for once didn't belong to a stolen car long since abandoned. Forget it, my partner insisted. It was nothing. The district attorney's office wouldn't be interested. The most I could get was a misdemeanor battery charge from the city attorney, he said. I would remain on loan from uniformed patrol to the rape investigation team only a few more weeks, and heaven knows we had two major rapists working our area, and even more important to the bureaucracy, tons of overdue follow-up reports to be made for an upcoming audit. But something about this nothing attempted kidnapping case captured me, making it my obsession during my brief investigative loan. The car was registered to a man named Jesse. It would take just a few moments. Run the name for a driver's license information. Run the name and birth date for a criminal record. After all, criminals do sometimes caper in their own cars. Bingo. Numerous prior arrests for kidnap and rape or attempted rape, with a few car thefts and more. There was a gap of over 5 years, then one arrest for assault and another year silent on his record. I ordered a booking photo from his last arrest and began to work frantically on my pile of other cases while I waited for it to arrive. But I couldn't wait. I stumbled through the delays and transfers, calling the various police departments involved in his past, trying to locate crime reports, now 6 years old. Hard to find and even harder to read from the blurred copies. Each case was virtually identical. Each time he had accosted the girl on the sidewalk or parking lot, and each time he dragged her into a car, either his or hers. As rapists go, he wasn't highly successful. Half of his victims had been spared the ultimate indignity. Whatever the problems were that drove him to rape also prevented him from leaping confidently into it. When his photograph arrived, I stared long and hard at his odd light eyes, the expression on his face. Great care is required in preparing a photo lineup of six pictures to show a victim so that it will pass the court's test of fairness. Each subject has to approximate the victim's description so that the possible suspect won't stand out like a sore thumb. My victim looked at it only 2 seconds, pointed to Jesse and shuddered. His eyes, I can't forget those awful eyes. My security guard witness studied the photos, giving proper respect to each, and stated emphatically, "There's no doubt about it, that's him. I couldn't forget those eyes." Jesse had been in prison for the various assaults and thefts in one trial, with all pending cases combined. He had done more than 5 years in prison, had been paroled, and survived only a month before threatening his wife with a shotgun and getting thrown back in for a year's parole violation. He had been paroled again, just 7 days before the assault on my victim. He was now living with his wife and infant son, the product of his 1 month of freedom the year before, in an adjacent division. Armed with a special arrest warrant allowing me to arrest him in his own home, we approached the house. The car was there, and a tow truck was ready to take it away for us. I also had a warrant to seize it and search every inch of it. His description and car matched another kidnap rape so perfectly that I was sure we had him on that one too. But unfortunately, would result in nothing decisive. Her fractured jaw wired shut, this victim would describe his car, but with two details significantly different, and she would pick suspects from the photo lineup and live lineup at the county jail, most similar in every detail to Jesse, without really looking at or commenting on him. That case fell by the wayside later, leaving me with the personal conviction, which I never quite gave up, that she was too terrified to identify him. The man with the eyes of violence opened the door at my knock. The smile faded instantly, and the new velour bathrobe must have suddenly become overly warm as his forehead broke into a sweat. I dangled the warrant in his face and gave him the good news. He asked only that he be allowed to dress. My male partners accompanied him upstairs, leaving me alone with his disbelieving wife. All 250 pounds of that woman shook with rage. What did I mean, kidnap and attempted rape? This man had slept with her every night since his release, she bellowed. Well, he had gone to sleep with her and woke up with her, but admittedly, she couldn't account for every moment in between, as she, too, had slept. But she knew it wasn't possible. Not again. I thereby resolved that in the future, I'd help the suspect dress and let my partners face such wrath. Her desperate grip on her crying son seemed to be all that spared me a physical assault. The deputy district attorney had been specific in his order to bring the man's wallet along. It hadn't registered as terribly important, but it was in order. At the station, we advised Jesse of his rights under Miranda and gave him his chance to present his side of the story. He would tell us all, if only we wouldn't tell his wife. Yes, it was true. He had slipped out of the house during the night in question to find a whore in Hollywood. He had found one and had stopped for gas when she grabbed his wallet and ran. Frantically, he had cruised the streets looking for her, needing his money and knowing he'd be unable to explain the loss of his wallet to his wife, and thought he had found her. Of course, the location he gave for losing her was far beyond walking distance to where he had grabbed my victim, firmly believing, he said, that she was the one with his wallet. As soon as he grabbed her, neglecting the part about her being stuffed inside his car, and just when the security guard approached, disregarding his threats to kill the guard, he realized that she wasn't the long-lost hooker and willingly let her go. He paused, and I waited for him to go on, slowly turning in my hand the well-used leather wallet brimming with his identification and papers. When he failed to continue, I noted, "Jesse, I have your wallet." The sweat was really pouring from his forehead now. Finally, he broke the silence and stated weakly, "Well, I saw the right one later, and she threw it back to me. But victory was not to be mine just yet. Before the deputy DA would file this unusual case, I had to have the consent of at least one prior victim to testify against Jesse in order to establish that his intent was to commit rape. Without that, he reminded me, we only had a little old attempted kidnap. From the standpoint of our justice system, our helpful security guard had been too quick, had interrupted too soon. Good cases are measured by the completion of crimes, by the level of suffering or bloodshed of our victims. Since my victim had suffered so little, Jesse's prior victims would have to suffer again. Finding the current addresses and phone numbers of the girls proved easy. Triumphantly, I called the one whose case most resembled mine. But police reports and court records leave out the human aspects, the gory little details of how one coped or failed to cope with the personal assault and the aftermath of a bitter trial. Nowhere did I read how Karen, who was only an attempted rape victim, had been tormented by Jesse's friends, who had possession of her purse, identification, and other personal papers, how she had lost her job, her boyfriend, and even her mental health. Yes, I knew rape was tragic. It was an evil, painful intrusion into one's most private existence, an unfair robbery of the highest degree. But I never really examined the long-range effects. My time had come to learn. Karen had regained her strength and found a new job and a new boyfriend. I can't not express how small I felt when she came unglued over the phone. I apologized, left my name and number, and said I'd never call again. I stared at that dumb old phone for a portion of eternity before I could dial another victim. The next two were reluctant, but agreed to meet the deputy district attorney and talk about it, with no commitment about testifying, one step at a time. Ellen would arrive clutching her Bible. She said simply, "If I hadn't found him, I'd be in a funny farm right now." Tanya would be our tower of strength, though she insisted she felt more like a puddle of warm jello. The deputy district attorney would inspire them with the need to put Jesse back in prison for a year or more, and thereby spare someone else the suffering they had endured for at least a little longer. It was the best we could do, and we needed them. They would show up for the preliminary trial. Meanwhile, my 48-hour hold on the suspect, during which I had to file the case or drop the whole matter, had long since expired. Jesse was in jail thanks only to his parole officer, who could hold him 7 days pending a report of his alleged violation of parole. What a patient, trusting man he was. Unable to complete his report until I'd accomplished some sort of action, I know he must have been relieved when I finally called to verify that I'd just filed attempted kidnap and attempted rape charges on Jesse. A mere 6.5 days had elapsed. Police officers, uniformly bitter about the liberal courts that let hardcore criminals walk away from crimes of every degree, are often suspicious of parole officers, who also have a hand in deciding when a criminal sees daylight again. But with Jesse's parole agent around it, there was still hope. Jesse's attorney, with his irritating personality and his unfortunate but distracting stutter, had been annoyed by the delay in filing. He couldn't get copies of the police reports until then, and he was anxious, he said, to contact the victim and get this thing over with. It was, after all, merely a simple case of mistaken identity, and he would explain it all and have the victim sign off the case. Did he really believe that? Hadn't he seen the defendant's prior record? I offered to let him read the past cases, but he didn't have time. Carefully, I explained to my victim and witness that they might be contacted by the attorney, who would offer explanations and possibly even money to drop the case. They had the right to talk to him if they desired. I had to be careful. I wasn't to pressure them on the matter. I had already told my victim of the search for the other victims and why it was needed to put an MO to show his modus operandi, his method of operation. She hesitated and then answered, "Well, I don't think I'm going to talk to him. I guess this case is kind of special. I was really pretty lucky, wasn't I?" The preliminary trial went smoothly, my victim patiently surviving the defense attorney's attempts to confuse her and reverse her statements. She handled it much better than I would have done, since I have always found it difficult not to react to the absurd statements made by such desperate defense attorneys in the courtroom. The deputy district attorney stated our intentions to call one of the prior victims to the stand to show the suspect's intent, and we waited breathlessly for the judge to decide whether or not he would allow it. A suspect's prior record, as such, is not generally admissible in court. The judge didn't need to hear anything more to make his decision, and he had made it clear that he was in a hurry to get out early. He listened to the defense attorney's objections, studied the expressions on my face, and the district attorney beside me. Though there was no communication before or after, I'm sure he knew our thoughts. If denied at the preliminary, we might have a tougher time getting the testimony admitted in trial before another judge. Tanya testified calmly and effectively. The attorney made a motion to dismiss the entire case as it was a big nothing and we hadn't proved any sexual intentions. The judge merely replied, "Now, for what other reason does a man drag a woman off the street? Defendant is held to answer." Clearly defeated, Jesse would plead guilty on his trial date and hope for a lenient judge at sentencing time. My victim could now blank out this interruption in her life, and the prior victims could move ahead cautiously, wondering how long before they would be called again and be reminded of what they'd never been able to forget anyway. I certainly didn't want to be the one to call them again. While searching Jesse's car, I had read his letters to his wife, written while in prison, full of promises to be a good father and husband and never to stray again. He would be a different man, he wrote just 2 weeks before his release. I also read his notation that the psychiatrist did not want him paroled because of extremely violent tendencies. I had read his thoughts, seen inside his soul. Maybe someday I'll pick up my typewriter again, drag my old journalism career out of hiding, and write something about this creature I had come to know so well. Well enough to know that those haunting eyes of violence would surface again someday in the photo lineups of other rape investigations, and the nightmares of his victims yet to be. Note: true to form, this suspect indeed was arrested repeatedly after his release on this case for ongoing sexual assaults and other violent crimes.
End of watch.
Each week on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, and Blue Lives Radio, we read the names of the law enforcement officers who lost their lives in the line of duty during the previous week. This week, I have a number of names to read, unfortunately. We will start off with Detective Benjamin Marconi of the San Antonio Police Department, Texas. Detective Benjamin Marconi was shot and killed from ambush as he conducted a traffic stop of a vehicle near the intersection of West Nueva Street and Santa Rosa Street at approximately 11:45 a.m. Detective Marconi was sitting in his patrol car during the stop when an unrelated subject stopped his car behind Detective Marconi's patrol car. The man walked up to the passenger side and shot Detective Marconi once in the head. The man then leaned into the patrol car and shot him a second time. The suspect has been taken into custody. Detective Marconi served with the San Antonio Police Department for 20 years. He's survived by his two children. End of watch, Sunday, November 20th, 2016. The Deputy Sheriff Eric Oliver of the Nassau County Sheriff's Office in Florida. Detective Deputy Sheriff Eric Oliver was struck and killed by a vehicle while involved in a foot pursuit of a suspect near the intersection of County Road 200 and Chester Road at approximately 7:30 a.m. He and another deputy had responded to back up several United States Border Patrol agents who were interviewing several subjects at a gas station. One of the subjects being questioned fled on foot, with Deputy Oliver and the second deputy in pursuit. Deputy Oliver was struck by a vehicle as he chased the subject across the roadway. Deputy Oliver was a U.S. Navy veteran. He is survived by his wife and 6-year-old daughter. His end of watch, Tuesday, November 22nd, 2016. Trooper Eric Ellsworth of the Utah Highway Patrol. Trooper Eric Ellsworth succumbed to injuries sustained when he was struck by a vehicle at approximately 9:45 p.m. on November 18th, 2016. He had responded to reports of a low-hanging power line on Route 13 in Box Elder County. He was waiting for the local power company to arrive when he observed a semi-truck approaching. As he exited his patrol car to warn the driver of the obstruction, he was struck by a vehicle traveling in the opposite direction. He succumbed to his injuries 4 days later. He had served with the Utah Highway Patrol for 7 years. He is survived by his wife, 3 young sons, and parents. His father is a retired Highway Patrol trooper as well. His end of watch, Tuesday, November 22nd, 2016. The fourth name to read is Police Officer Colin James Rose of the Wayne State University Police Department in Michigan. Police Officer Colin Rose succumbed to a gunshot wound sustained the previous day while questioning a suspicious person near the university's downtown campus. Officer Rose was in an area that had experienced numerous thefts from vehicles the previous day. He informed dispatchers that he was making contact with a suspicious person in front of 3650 Lincoln Street. During the encounter, Officer Rose attempted to detain the man, but the subject suddenly pulled out a gun, shot him in the head. The suspect then fled the scene, was arrested later in the night. He had served with the Wayne State University Police Department for 5.5 years and served as a canine officer with that agency. He previously served with the Richland Police Department. He's survived by his fiancée. End of watch for Police Officer Colin James Rose, Wednesday, November 23rd, 2016. The final name to read for this week is Trooper Cody James Donahue of the Colorado State Patrol in Colorado. Trooper Cody Donahue was struck and killed by a commercial vehicle on northbound I-25 at Toma Road near Castle Rock. He was investigating a minor traffic crash when the commercial vehicle struck him when he was outside of his patrol car with another trooper. He was wearing a reflective vest at the time that he was struck. Trooper Donahue had served with Colorado State Patrol for 11 years. He is survived by his wife and 2 young children. End of watch, Friday, November 25th, 2016. These police officers, troopers, and deputies made the ultimate sacrifice. May they rest in peace. I want to thank you so much for tuning in to this week's episode of Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network.